Hello, welcome back. So you want to be an international arbitrator. In this, the second installment of our eight-part podcast series, I'm going to discuss arbitrator selection, something near and dear to everyone's heart. Now, the party's agreement, or the arbitration clause, will provide the dominant method for selecting arbitrators, or the chosen method. The usual one is each side, you'll see in an international case, each side will pick one arbitrator and the two so appointed will select the chair. If there's no agreement on who the chair should be, then the provider organization that's designated in the agreement will appoint a chair. Sometimes that chair will be from a country, we'll call it a neutral country in which neither party comes from. The rule about acting as an arbitrator is that arbitrators in international cases shall be impartial and independent. Now, JAMS Rule 8.1 uses that language, quote, impartial and independent, unquote. The disclosures in international arbitrations will be usually less detailed than in domestic cases, and let me discuss them. There's a continuing obligation of disclosure, like in domestic cases. And this disclosure contemplates disclosures related to bias, any interest in the dispute, relationship with the parties, or counsel. Now, the UNCITRAL rules use the phrase, quote, justifiable doubt, and you also see that, in other words, whether they're the nominated arbitrator believes there may be justifiable doubt about his independence or impartiality, and if there could be, the arbitrator is supposed to disclose that. JAMS and the ICDR have a detailed questionnaire similar to the domestic one that you're used to that all arbitrators will have to complete. Other providers, most others, the ICC, for example, do not have a questionnaire. You just have to make disclosures as you deem them appropriate. Now, what do you have to disclose? We in the United States, especially the Californians, are used to wider disclosure than the rest of the world, perhaps because the old guard didn't want to disclose so much that they'd be disqualified. However, the International Bar Association, or the IBA, which is roughly the worldwide equivalent of the ABA, has promulgated four color-coded lists with requirements recommendations updated in late 2014. If you want to access the IBA list, you should just Google IBA arbitration disclosures, and you will wind up with a report that will list exhaustively what I'm about to tell you in very summary form. There are four lists in the IBA rules. There's a non-waivable red list. They're color-coded. There's red, orange, and green. And there are two reds, a waivable and a non-waivable. The non-waivable red, which constitutes, if you have any of these, an automatic disqualification. You can't be the lawyer or an employee on the board of directors of a party. You can't have controlling influence, significant financial or personal interest in a party or outcome. Or you or your law firm cannot derive significant income from a party or an affiliate. The waivable red list constitutes those things which are presumptively disqualifying but can be waived. That is, the nominated arbitrator has given legal advice to a party or an affiliate or has a direct or indirect interest, you or your family, or a close family relationship with a party. Then there's the orange list, which is not presumptively disqualified. These lists, by the way, are all detailed in the IBA report, which you can access. Previous service to a party, it should be disclosed, but not as critical as red. If the arbitrator has within 3 years served as a lawyer, has consulted in an unrelated matter, but has no ongoing relationship with a party, or the arbitrator within the past 3 years have been appointed two or more times as an arbitrator by one of the parties or counsel. The green list, which is probably fine, and you don't even have to disclose it, but if you're compulsive about it, you might. For example, the arbitrator is a member of the same bar association as one of the lawyers. Now, the IBA guidelines that I've just noted to you are not used, are not declared to be the guidelines which satisfy organizations such as the ICC. the rule at the ICC that you have to be impartial and independent, and the Unser-Trau rule in which if there's justifiable doubt, you have to disclose it, will trump these lists. However, using this these lists constitute good guidelines for determining whether or not you should make certain disclosures. Now, what do you do when you're contacted? And the phone rings, and one of the lawyers you know says, we'd like to appoint you as our party-appointed arbitrator in an international proceeding. In the international context, you may participate in an interview process. And the ABA, in conjunction with the AAA, has promulgated guidelines for use in the interview process, which are pretty widely used internationally as well. And while they aren't binding, JAMS uses them as well. And what do they allow? The person calling you obviously can't ask about the merits or about matters that would be indicative of how you would make any determination on the merits. They can ask about your availability, whether you have the time to serve, whether you're how much you charge, and they can also ask about general qualifications about the subject matter that you're being considered to hear. Now, do you have the time to serve effectively? The ICC had a task force a while ago that dealt with things like this, and now there are special rules for the ICC. They have a form. All nominated arbitrators have to answer, how many cases are you sitting on? How many are you chair? How many are you one of the wings? How many are sole arbitrator? And do you have the time to devote to the case so that it can be done in a reasonable amount of time? As far as compensation, many institutions dictate the rate. And some will dictate the rate for some cases and not others. Netherlands arbitration will dictate a rate to you. The LCIA will dictate a rate. And you should ask what the rates will be at some point, or you'll be told what they are so that you will know. And the rates will differ depending on the amount and controversy, the type of case it is. The one big exception is the ICC, and they will pay a lump sum based on the amount and controversy. And you go on the website, which is www.iccwbo.org, and there is something called a calculator, which if you surf around, you'll find, which will tell you if you put in the number of arbitrators and the amount of controversy, it will give you a range from minimum to maximum and an average that you will earn as an arbitrator by going through the entire process. For example, on a $200,000 case, the minimum is about $5,700. The maximum is $23,500. I'm rounding here. And the average is about $14,500. In contrast, if there's a $15 million in controversy at the ICC and you're the sole arbitrator, you make a minimum of $42,367, a maximum of $199,450, and an average of about $121,000. Now, two final notes about the interview. It's fine if the client reps, the lawyers, want to participate in the interview, and they will expect you to consult with them about the choice of the chair. This is very important. The rules permit you to do that, virtually all the rules of the institutions, and the IBA rules permit a wing arbitrator to consult the party who appointed him and her as to who should sit as the chair. In fact, they not only like to be involved. If you choose a chair without consulting them, you can pretty much expect you will never be selected again. Very important, that selection, and make sure that the party who appointed you participates. So thanks for listening. You're already 25% of the way toward becoming an international arbitrator, or at least 25% of the way through the podcast series. I look forward to joining you again in part 3.